It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While our physical schools are closed, school is in session on Talk of Iowa. On Tuesdays, the subject is biology. And on Thursdays, we dig into Iowa history. This week, we'll learn about what life was like during World War II here in Iowa, and also the contributions that Iowans made around the world. Now, our resident biology teacher, Jim Pease, has been with us now for 8 weeks. Our biology classes will continue through the end of the school year, but this is Jim's last day with us for a while because apparently he's got work to do. Jim Pease, thank you so much for being here and for being such a great teacher for the last 8 weeks and then also the 25 or so years before that.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you, Charity. It's been great fun. Did you have a good Mother's Day?
I did have a good Mother's Day. And of course, on Sunday, we celebrated human mothers. Most of us celebrated human mothers. But today, we're going to talk about mothers of all different kinds of species. Dads, too, right?
Absolutely. Parenting is a really important part of nature, from wild nature to more domestic nature. That parenting means that the next generation is coming up, and nature teaches us that there are lots of right ways to do it. There's not a single right way. As humans, we tend to think in terms of sort of one right way, but in fact, when we look at other human cultures and the broader spectrum of nature, we see, gee whiz, there are lots of right ways that different species have of bringing up youngsters and bringing the next generation into this world. So it's really, really interesting, too, because much of wild parenting by other species is done sort of instinctively. It's not to say there's not some teaching done in some species, and in fact there is, but much of it is not learned behavior. It's totally instinctive, and that's always fascinating to me to say, gee, how did they learn that particular behavior to make sure that the young are successful? It's fascinating to think about and to watch as it happens around us.
Absolutely. And of course, we invest so much time and energy as humans in our children and so much time and energy in teaching them, especially lately. We are very hands-on with education these days as parents. It's hard to...
And everything else.
Right. It's hard to imagine how these other species maybe don't invest that kind of time. But every species has the same goal, right? Because we want our genes to continue.
Absolutely. And we want that next generation to continue the species. That is the whole point of life, in fact, in many ways, is to bring that next, we have this insatiable desire to have that next generation continue the species. So and that goes across the spectrum from viruses like we're dealing with now to bacteria and all the way up to human beings. It's this insatiable desire. And the amount of, and you've used the term investment, and that's a really great term to think about because, or to describe it, because it's a matter of parental investment. How much parental investment, how much energy, how much time and effort am I going to put in to making sure that my species continues? Let's take rabbits, for example, because that's something most people can look out their windows and see rabbits in town, out in the country, wherever you live. There are cottontail rabbits here in Iowa, all over the place, and there are lots of baby bunnies out there right now, at birth. So these cottontails are placed in a sort of a shallow, maybe 4 to 6 inch deep hole. It's covered with fur that is sort of torn from the belly of the mother. And then she covers that after she has the little ones in the hole. She covers that with some leaves and grass. And sometimes these nests, you look at it and you say, why did they put it in the middle of the lawn? Why didn't they put it over underneath the shrubs or hidden in the flowers? And really, that's a matter of perhaps thought process, or at least the experience of the mother, in avoiding predators, in keeping the young from being taken. Because these young are born naked and blind, and they can't hear, and they're in this nest in the ground. So these are altricial youngsters. We've run into that word before in earlier programs, meaning that they take a lot of parental investment, a lot of care by the mother or the father to get to the point where they can leave that nest. Now, they're often you think in the middle of the lawn has got to be the worst place. Lawnmower predators, dogs, kids, all kinds of predators can come and find those. But in fact, it's probably much safer in the middle of the lawn than it is, although rabbits didn't understand lawnmower predators, much safer in the middle of the lawn than it would be over in the shrubs where predators from dogs to cats to raccoons and possums and skunks and all kinds of other predators might search, and foxes would search for them in that cover area. So it's probably not a bad choice. And in terms of where's mom, why doesn't she sit on the nest? That would certainly attract predators. So she leaves that nest off by itself, and she only visits that nest about once a day in the twilight hours, usually in the morning, but maybe in the evening, where she will feed them. She will nurse them for about a minute and a half.
A minute and a half, okay.
A minute and a half.
They're very efficient eaters.
Absolutely. You've got to be fast. It sort of reminds me of competing with my brothers at the dinner table growing up. No, that's my milk. Those are my potatoes. we're competing for that food. We're eating as fast as we can. It's quite an amazing thing to think that she visits them once a day. Of course, now we'll come across that nest. We'll look around. We don't see the mother, and we say, ah, they've been abandoned. But that's a misinterpretation, because her mothering instincts say, stay away from them, give them the food they need, but only in a short period of time, and then stay away because it keeps the predators away. But we misinterpret that oftentimes, and then we take these baby bunnies to a wildlife rehabber or a vet and say, can you care for them? They were abandoned by their mother. They weren't abandoned at all. The mother is just not hanging around constantly. She visits them just often enough to make them allow them to grow. And I can tell you from having done research on another one on snowshoe hares up in northern Alberta, where I did my master's research, those mothers are around, because we would live trap lots of baby bunnies and adults, but when you're handling them to mark them and measure them and everything, see how they're doing, they will scream. And if you've never heard a rabbit scream, a hare or a cottontail, they do scream. And I've had a number of times when I was working on a young hare, they'd be screaming, and an adult would come down the trail and circle around me while I'm working on this younger rabbit. So they're around. You just don't always see them.
They care. They just are doing right. It in a specific way that works best for their species. We've also talked about this in the past. They're playing a numbers game as well, because, I have two children. That's pretty common for human parents. Right. I'm investing a lot of energy into those two children so that their genes carry forward, and because I love them and all of those things as well. The mother rabbit is not investing all that much energy, but she's producing a lot of children. So she's rolling the dice and saying, some of my children will carry my genes forward. Some of them will survive.
Right, exactly. And that's often the case with species. The lower your parental investment, there's a tendency to have a larger number of young. In so-called higher species like humans and apes and other things, you might have fewer young, but you put a greater parental investment into them to make sure that some survive to carry on those genes. Deer, for example, that's another one that we often misinterpret. We'll find this spotted little fawn lying in the grass, and you think, gee, why are they spotted? Well, they camouflage themselves really well. Lying in the grass, they lie very, very still. They have, when they're quite young, they really don't have any smell to them, so it makes it very difficult for predators to smell them out. You would think baby deer would have this incredible smell. They smell, you know, the smell of a newborn, but they don't. And so it makes it very difficult for predators to find them. But the spottedness, and they're left by themselves, lying, sleeping in these areas. And it's amazing the camouflage, how well the sunlight coming through the leaves looks an awful lot like the spots on a fawn.
Yeah, they can just disappear.
Look like the devil. Yeah, exactly. They really do. And the mother is nearby, but she's often not visible to you at all. So we come upon this fawn by accident, and we say, "Oh, it's been abandoned," because we don't see the mother. Not abandoned. Leave them alone. They'll do just fine without any help. I think people want to help. Motherhood takes many forms, and we have to allow that to take its own form in other species.
And that's really important to remember this time of year, because as a lot of us are spending time outside, a lot of us are going to come across fawns, and it's magical and exciting to see one, but that doesn't mean
it
you
is.
Need to save it. And if you try
exactly
to save
right.
it, in fact, wildlife rehabilitators in Iowa are not even allowed to help white-tailed deer right now. So please
right.
leave fawns right. alone.
Leave them alone. Yeah.
That's all right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, school is in session with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we are learning about parenting in the wild. And hey, kids, we want to hear from you today. As you learn about all of these wild parents, we want you to call or send an email. Tell us what species your parents are most like. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. School is in session on Talk of Iowa today. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me, and we are learning about parenting in the wild today. And we want to hear from you. Let us know, especially for kids, what species your parents are most like when you think about their parenting styles. And it doesn't just have to be species that we talk about today. It could be a species that you've learned about on your own, or one that you've heard about in recent weeks on Talk of Iowa. For example, we know that beavers are very hands-on parents, that they'll even invest sometimes a couple of years into their kids, and maybe the older brothers and sisters will help out as well. Think about what your parents are like and what wildlife is like, and give us a call, 866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, we talked about cottontail rabbits. We talked about white-tailed deer. And you kind of break down these different mothering styles into different categories. So we've talked about the I'm your mom and I'll be around, but not very much kind of mothering style. What are some
right.
of the other styles?
Well, let's take another common species and that we see in both rural and urban ponds all around us. And that's the mallard duck. Mallard ducks have a very high parental investment on the female side, on mom's side, but not on the males. Once the female starts to set on the eggs, the males kind of, they lose interest in the relationship. It's kind of like, oh my golly, when she's going to be off those eggs? And so the males kind of go off by themselves, and they join, let's say they go to the bar, in this case, the sandbars, and get in bachelor groups with other males. Now, I've never seen them playing cards and, you know, smoking cigars and that, but anyway, they're out in these sandbars, and they really have no further investment in the young. The female, once the eggs are hatched, these are precocial young. That means that they're within 24 hours, they're out walking around, their eyes are open, they have are covered with down, and they're out swimming immediately with their mother. as soon as they've within a few hours after they've hatched. And so she does all the rest of the raising. Sometimes she will join with other hens, they're called, with other females that have young as well. So you'll sometimes see these great big groups with a couple of females, and you say, my golly, did one of those mothers hatch all those? No, they're probably two, and they're sort of banding together in sort of female and young groups. So the males have a very little investment. Now, there are some birds that do the reverse of that. There are birds we talked about earlier about some of the shorebirds, and this is a shorebird that comes through Iowa on its way to the Arctic. So we only see them briefly here, but when they get to the Arctic, this is a bird called the phalarope, P-H-A-L-A-R-O-P-E, a phalarope, and people can look it up, and there are several different species of it. But the female, unlike in mallards, the female of the phalarope is brightly colored. She does all the displaying to attract a male. She initiates the nesting activity, and the male is the cryptic colored one, the one that is blends in so well. Once she lays the eggs, she's done with it. She's done with the relationship. The male sits on the eggs, raises the young. She goes off into the female group, so without the males around at all. So the male incubates the eggs and takes care of the offspring. So motherhood takes many forms. Parental investment can be reversed sometimes. Then we take let's take a smaller critter like the honeybee. And a honeybee is amazing for so many reasons. I happen to be a beekeeper, and so I'm always fascinated by them. But if you think about them, here's a colony made up of about 50,000 sisters, if you will. These are all female offspring of one queen, their mother. She's a single mom. She was impregnated by dozens of drones, the males of the species, during her maiden flight. A little promiscuous there, but she lays the eggs, and all her daughters are then in charge sort of the hive. They do all the work. They clean the cells. They tend and feed the larva. They feed the queen. They do her heating and air conditioning specialist for the hive, keeping it the right temperature and humidity. They defend the hive. They're the soldiers of the hive. They produce wax, so they're construction engineers as well. They can fly up to a mile away in any direction in order to find food. So they're the farmers of the hive as well. And they turn that nectar that they collect from flowers on those flights into honey. So it's just, it's amazing. It has just the right amount of moisture, too, so that it doesn't rot. And it becomes this amazing product that they have from the hive. So, and they do this all in the course of about 3 weeks. 3 to 4 weeks is the lifespan of a worker bee in a hive. So sisterhood is very, very powerful in that hive. And when you think about all the jobs they do in a four-week span, I think as a human youngster, you can no longer complain about having to feed the dog or take out the trash. It's a whole different deal if you are a worker bee in a honeybee hive. Sisterhood's powerful, and so is that the genetics of that hive.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, and I think about, again, in making comparisons between human parents and wild parents. Now, I don't think very many of us are like honeybees, but there are these situations where a group raises the young. You talked about with the mallard ducks, sometimes many of the ducklings will end up following one mother. And we see that with other bird species as well. When we look at coyote packs or wolf packs, we often see there's this colonial raising of the young. It takes a village to raise the young. And humans used to be a little more like that in the past. I think we've moved away from that. But that's kind of interesting that we've seen our role changing.
Absolutely, and it is fascinating when you think about how, as our society has progressed, how in fact we've moved away from parental investment in so many young. It used to be in a much more agrarian society. We had lots of kids. to maybe have a few. We knew that some weren't going to survive, so we'd have 12, 14 kids in a given family, hoping that some would survive to adulthood. And now, many fewer than that. I think it's 2.1 in the U.S. here. It's actually under that per couple. So it's really changed as society has changed. And you're right. It can be that sort of communal form. And certainly there are some forms of human society where that communal raising of the young is more common. Certainly. There are some forms of parenthood that we would recognize quite readily and even identify with. Let's take the house wren, again, common in urban Iowa as well as rural Iowa. The pair, the male and the female, share the load of nest building, of incubating the eggs, they feed the young. However, there's a slight twist here. The males may maintain more than one household. Which keeps them pretty busy during the breeding season, because if they've got a female in two houses at the opposite ends of the yard, which is quite common, they have to help both females out raising those young. So they're pretty busy little guys, it's pretty amazing. If you look at the eaglets that we talked about in the very first program of this series that we did, if you look at the Decorah eagles, both the male and the female are participating in raising those young ones. They're both bringing food now. The eaglets are almost a month out of, I guess, a little over a month out of the hatching. So they're growing, and as they grow, they need more and more food all the time. So both parents are kept busy bringing in food to those young ones. So it sometimes varies from species to species how strong that pair bond is between the parents and how much they both participate in raising the young. And it's quite common.
Jim, we're getting some feedback from kids, so I want to share a little bit, and I'll throw out that number again. You are welcome to join our conversation. We're asking kids to tell us what species their parents are most like. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Stephen shared that his son Peter says that mom is like a beaver because she's hands-on, dad is like a bunny because before quarantine, he used to leave for most of the day.
That's great.
Excellent so, insight.
Combination of species, that's good. Yeah, that's good. But now if he's home, is he more like the beaver as well? I participate. Wait, we won't ask.
Right. Cedric is on the line in Marshalltown. Hello, Cedric.
Hello.
Hi, you've got some insight on this too. What are your observations?
I think that my parents are like species of hornbill that live in Africa because the female and the male go into a hole and then they wall themselves in. The female and the male wall the female in the hole with the nest and the eggs so that no predators can get in there, and the male comes back and forth and brings food to the female until the babies hatch.
All right. And so
that's great.
If your mom's staying home and your dad is going out to work, then they're like hornbills.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're all trapped in the nest right now, though, Cedric?
I wouldn't say trapped, because usually the nest is a pretty good size. Otherwise, it'd feel kind of crowded. We live in the country and there's a lot of stuff to do out here. So it's kind of like that.
Nice. Well, Cedric, thank you so much for sharing your observation with us. And of course, we would love to hear from you as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And some familiar kids are on the line. My kids have called in, Jim. Audrey and Carter are on the line in Iowa City. Hello, kids.
Hi.
All right. So, Audrey, you want to go first? What species do you think Dad and I are most like?
Well, since you guys get to leave every day, I was thinking that you were basically just like a regular songbird people, you know, because, you know, we stay home at the nest while you guys go out and you do stuff and then you come back and sometimes you bring us food. So
that sounds about right. What do you think, Carter?
Yeah.
More like beavers, because guys stay with us mostly.
All right, and we take relatively good care of you.
Yeah.
So if you think about the Decora Eagles, both parents are bringing food home occasionally, the younger staying in the nest, and they're coming back at night, keep you warm, that sort of thing. But there's a certain point in the eaglet's life, and we'll see this over the next month and a half. We already saw, I was watching the eaglets this morning, and one of them, the largest one, is out there sort of flapping his wings. He's trying out his wings. Pretty soon, the young will get out on the edge of the nest, and they'll become what we call branchers. Well, they'll actually climb up some of the branches that the nest are beside the nest, and they'll try those wings out. And it looks incredibly dangerous to a parent, although eagle parents are really good. They know that this has to happen. So do you think your parents are letting you try your wings out as well? They give you some freedom to explore and do those things?
Well, they do let us go outside, so... Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. I've explained on this program before that I grew up in a family of wildlife rehabilitators, so I've had a really unusual opportunity to get to observe animals over the years. And one of the things that I was able to learn because of that, we have raised some crows. And crows, like eagles, you know, as they grow, they learn to fly and spread their wings, and they go out and they come back and they ask for food. And they have this very cute way of asking for food where they kind of duck their heads and they wiggle their wings a little bit and they make their baby sounds. And they do it even when they look like grown crows. And so I was thinking about that today, because once I learned about this behavior among crows that were being raised by a rehabilitator, I started hearing and seeing it in nature, where even in August, when you would think that these crows would be on their own, you could hear them begging for food from their parents. And I thought maybe I'm like a mother crow in August right now, because I have kids who are 12 and 14, and they are spreading their wings and they're learning to be independent, but when they ask me for help, I am more than happy to give it to them. Carter, do you think that describes me? Maybe I'm a mommy crow?
Yeah, kind of.
All right, well, I'll let you guys go, but thank you for calling.
Do they beg for food?
on occasion, they do. We all do sometimes, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, kids. And Jim, thanks for being my kid's biology teacher for the last 8 weeks. I really, really appreciate that. So we've talked about some of those mothers and fathers that are a little more invested. So those tend to have fewer young, right? Because they have to spend a lot more time taking care of them.
Right. In fact, a lot of songbirds go through this. And you mentioned not just songbirds, but other birds as well. You mentioned how the length of time that the parent spends in raising those young varies a lot. The eagles may be with their parents clear into the winter. In fact, in a few instances, we're seeing now where there seems to be not just in eagles, but in geese and other things. One of, usually female, it appears, of the young of the previous year will help raise the young of the next of their mother the following year. So they're sort of assistants in the story. And it's interesting when you think about, do they teach them to do that? Well, they're certainly learning, but somehow they're contributing as well. So there's a lot of that in nature. And we see this food begging. You mentioned crows, and we'll hear clear into the fall. You know, we great horned owls and barred owls now have young that are more than half grown, in fact, especially great horned owls. I'm seeing lots of pictures with, fairly large, almost full-grown owls and still very downy young owls. And clear into the fall, you'll hear this, "Mom! Dad! Food!"
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about parenting in the wild today, and we'd love to hear from you. Your observations, perhaps, of the parents in your life or your questions. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. School is in session with our resident biology teacher, Jim Pease. We're learning about parenting in the wild today. And of course, species have very different approaches to parenting. Some invest a lot of energy into their offspring, others very little. We'd love to hear from you as well if you have questions or your observations. Kids, tell us what species your parents are most like. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, we do have a question about one of the species we've already talked about. This is from Sarah in Des Moines. She says, "We have a mallard duck nest in our front yard, and the mother has been very attentive. We're not close to a pond, roughly a quarter of a mile. Should we worry about how she and her chicks will get to the water after they hatch?" And as an addendum, she says, "We've opened our backyard pool since she started sitting on her nest, and we're worried that she's going to get confused."
Well, she may use your pool temporarily, but there's not much food there for her or for the young, so I wouldn't worry about it. And in fact, it's not unusual for ducks and geese to nest quite a ways away from water. I know of research in southeastern Iowa, in fact, where wood ducks nest up to a mile away from water. And because they found that cavity, they're cavity nesters, they live in the holes in the trees. Fred Leopold did a lot of research on wood ducks down there, and he found that a mile away from water is no big deal. And the same is true with mallards and actually Canada geese. They will often nest quite a ways away from water. So I wouldn't worry about them. The pool may be temporary, but not for long. There's no food in there, so they'll move on to a pond that a quarter mile away, or even a lake or a river, a stream even, where they can find food.
And that can be really a very important, dangerous journey. I think it's a good time to revisit the classic childhood book "Make Way for Ducklings," because that was very much based in reality. At least the part where they had to walk to water, and those little ducklings had to follow their mama and cross the streets and all kinds of dangerous things. But most of them
I've seen geese. In fact, leading. They'll fly up on tops of houses, and people are saying, "What's this adult goose doing on top of?" And he's honking away, and he's saying, this way, I can see the pond." So they're sort of leading the goslings and the other member of the pair to the water source. So they're quite good. I was starting to say that food is a really important part of raising young, and there are different ways of providing that food. Vultures, for example, and this is a fairly common theme, you see this in a lot of seabirds, they have to regurgitate, sort of a make-your-own-baby food sort of thing. They regurgitate from their stomach or from their crop sometimes the food to the young, and it's partially digested and certainly easier to digest than for young. Mourning doves, very common bird across the state, they construct this sort of a nest, a few twigs thrown on top of branches, and if the eggs don't roll off and they become young, once they're hatched, the parents will feed them this milk, if you will, that is actually made up of cells from the inside of their crop. It's a baby food, a mushed up baby food, a milky liquid made from the skin cells inside their crop. Sounds delicious, doesn't it?
So good.
Really good, yeah. Now, life as a youngster doesn't last long for some. Some species, it's short. You have to learn quickly because they kick you out. Woodchucks and other common species are often called groundhogs or whistle pigs, and we've talked about those on other programs. Those are, once they get to be adult size, mom says, that's enough. You've got all the nurturing you're going to have. Get out of here. And it pushes them out of the underground den. And in fact, we often see in the late summer, this woodchucks are everywhere in new places where they weren't before. And these are almost always young woodchucks that are seeking a new territory because mom said, you had all the nurturing, all the mothering you're going to get. You're on your own now. It's pretty amazing.
We have an email from David. He says, while I've been working at home, I've noticed robins hopping precariously close to our cat, seemingly on purpose. Are they perhaps distracting our cat who may be too close to their nest, kind of like the wounded wing tactic of other birds? And that's a great observation. I think a lot of us are getting opportunities to see things that we normally don't get to see because we're looking out of our windows at home. But let's talk a little bit about that part of bird parenting, because after the baby birds leave the nest, a lot of them are on the ground for a little while. They're a little bit vulnerable.
They are. They can, in some cases, they're out of the nest for, because they've fallen out somehow, or they weren't quite ready to fly, but they were adventurous and trying out those wings. Other times, however, they get pushed up. And one of the birds that is pretty fascinating to think about. It's a sort of a foster parent plan where the brown-headed cowbird, this is a bird that was typical on the prairies when the prairies were common across the central part of the U.S. And the cowbirds followed bison. And the bison, are wanderers. So, in fact, they would feed on the backs of bison. They would eat ticks and other insects, and they would eat at the feet of the bison, and insects that would get scared up by the bison's feet as they went through the grasses. But bison are nomadic, and if you as a bird took time to set up a territory, build a nest, lay the eggs, and raise the young, your food supply, which is the bison, are long gone. So they developed a way, and we call it nest parasitism, which is, I think it has connotations that we think, oh, they're parasites, they're laying their eggs in other birds' nests. But the reason for that is that their food supply was constantly moving. So they had to develop this method of laying their eggs in other birds' nests. Now, the cowbird eggs, it turns out, hatch a little quicker than often the nests of the species that they're sitting in, be it a yellow warbler or all kinds of birds that they parasitize. And they'll lay their eggs in these other birds' nests. So they hatch a little quicker, and they tend to be bigger. So they'll often push out those other young. Now, that's sometimes what you see lying on the ground are these other poor nestlings that have gotten pushed out by the cowbird parent.
You made cowbirds sound a lot more sympathetic than I've ever felt about them before, because this brood parasitism or nest parasitism seems really, really problematic to me. Because
I know, but you have to understand how it evolved.
Right. I understand. Right? I have a little more empathy for cowbirds now. But also, when baby birds fledge, when they are learning to fly, like a robin, for example, the parents will be around and they'll send up their alarm calls and they'll try to lead a predator away, right?
Oh, they do, absolutely, and they're very aggressive about it sometimes, trying to lead the predator. And I think the observation of the email writer was very good, because that's in fact what happens, is that they're displaying, much like the broken wing trick of the killdeer and a number of other birds. A wood duck, hens will do this. When I've been paddling on rivers, they'll hide their young back in the brush or the fallen trees somewhere, and they'll get out in the middle of the river and go, oh, I can't fly. And they're kind of flopping on the water, and they're leading you downstream. And they get you down 200-300 yards away from where the young were, and all of a sudden, oh, I can fly. And they go right over your head, go back to their young upriver. They're very smart about it. And that's, in fact, what robins are doing as well. Very defensive of their young. It's a good thing.
Mike is on the line from Let's, Iowa. So that must mean this is Mike of the Iowa Parrot Rescue. Hello, Mike. Mike, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. So you've got a baby bird begging behavior observation from all of your parrots?
Sure. Yeah, you were talking about the crows and other birds continuing to do their baby begging behaviors when they're older. And, of course, my guys, my bigger parrots, can live to be 60 or 80 years old. And even the fully adult, 10, 15 years old, will still do that same identical baby begging behavior. They'll crouch a little bit and half spread and flutter their wings and then hold their head up and beg for some of that regurgitant mash from mama. They'll do that with people or with other birds that they are bonded to.
So do you think this is a failure to launch kind of scenario, Mike, or do you think that this is a bonding behavior?
I think it's a bonding thing. I'm not an ornithologist, but I've seen it right across species, all the way from the little cockatiels and lovebirds up to the biggest macaws. And I don't think that it's a taught thing. I think that they just, show me you love me, right? Give me food.
Right. Oh, Mike, what a great observation.
As a weapon.
Right. Thanks so much for your call, Mike. 866-780-9100 is the number to call to share your observations of parenting behavior in the wild. And let's talk about a few more parenting styles, Jim.
Well, there are some, and we'll look at the reptiles, the snakes. They have a tough time. They have no parents at all. I mean, they do have parents, but they don't have parents to model behavior or anything else on. And egg-laying snakes, which are the majority of our snakes, the eggs are deposited in some damp, let's think about a fox snake, for example, a common Iowa snake. Their eggs are deposited, laid in some rotten log, or under a board or some discarded piece of material, and once they hatch, and the female leaves, once they hatch, they're a fraction of the size of the mother, and they have to begin to try to find something to eat totally on their own, no help, no training, no food other than the egg sac or the yolk sac that they came from. So they have to figure out what it is they can eat. And people say, well, snakes bite readily. That's one of the reasons. They learn very early on, you got to try things out, and you got to eat what you can, because I have no idea what to do. So it's totally instinctual. And even in species like rattlesnakes and garter snakes, which are called ovoviviparous, which means they hold the eggs within their body until they hatch, the young hatch within their body and are sort of, it looks like they're being live born, and they are, but there's absolutely no nurturing, no teaching from the mother. They're on their own. Once they hatch and crawl out, they have to find their way in life. That's what we call tough love. It's pretty tough, way to begin life, but they have to figure it out. We mentioned the wood ducks earlier. That's another one that always fascinates me, because they'll often be in a hole 20, 30 feet off the ground. And within 24 hours, these are precocial young. So mom is down on the ground calling to them, saying, get out of there. Come on down here. And they have little tiny wings, and they're covered with down. And they use the claws on their feet to crawl up the side, go out the hole, and flutter down, but not very well. And they bounce on the ground often. You think, oh my gosh, they're all committing suicide. They're falling from these wonder, big heights. But they're and mom then walks them, as I say, up to a mile away from the nest to get to water. So it's a pretty amazing.
Well, and they haven't had anything to eat at that point. That's
right.
Wow.
Nothing to eat other than the yolk that helps them get through the egg stage and allows them to grow. That's all they have, and they've had nothing to eat until And once they fall out of the nest and follow mom, then she teaches them how to eat.
All right, so don't complain as much when your parents make you go on a hike, because it could be a lot worse.
Is that coming from experience?
I'm just saying.
Uh-huh, okay. Exactly. They may be leading you to some wonderful experiences.
And we usually bring snacks, too.
Absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
I think about, I was looking at a nest of barn swallows today. They built a nest on the side of our house, and that's another species that really astonishes me, because as I was mentioning, you know, songbirds like a robin, they'll fledge from the nest and they'll bounce around on the ground for a while, learning to fly while their parents protect them. But swallows, they have to get it right the first time, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Once they leave the nest, and I'm thinking of cliff swallows or barn swallows. Cliff swallows are often over water. And so if you don't fly the first time, you're going to get wet. Or in the case of barn swallows, if they don't fly, they're going to hit the pavement. The other thing that swallows do, and lots of bird species do this, is when they defecate, when they poop in little bags. There's a little membrane that surrounds those, and the adults pick up that diaper, if you will, carry it well away from the nest, and drop it, usually in water or other things. And you think, well, why are they doing this? Lots of people who have swimming pools call me and say, oh my gosh, there are all these bird feces in the pool. And that's why, because they're carrying these away from the nest, dropping them in water, and it doesn't allow predators to find the way back to the nest. And if they just dropped them over the edge, it'd be a great signal to predators, oh, there's baby birds up here. But carry these diapers away.
That's incredible. There's so many species that we could talk about. And of course, we only have about a minute left. And this is your last class with us during this school or homeschool period on Talk of Iowa. Do you have a little bit of advice maybe for human parents to take away from this?
Yeah, absolutely. Nature has so much to teach us if only we're open to it and we get out there. So I really encourage parents and kids on your own, get out and explore. There's so much out there. And you can do it by get outdoors while keeping at a safe distance, wear your mask, and get out there and explore. Lots of things to see, lots of things to learn, if we're open to it. So get out in nature and become a part of it.
Well, and as I told my kids, I said, this summer may be the most similar to the summers of my childhood, because all of the things that we'd normally be doing during the summer have been canceled or will be canceled. And we're going to spend a lot of time just playing and exploring nature. So I hope everybody gets the opportunity to do that. And Jim Pease, thank you so much for being our teacher.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. For the last 8 weeks, he's been our resident biology teacher on Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.